Okay, let's get going here again. These winter days are tough, aren't they? Everybody doing okay? Got your snowshoes on? Down jackets? Wonderful. Anybody have any questions? I guess the lack of questions means the presentations have been so clear and complete, and that as Stanford students, you understand everything. Is that right? On the right track? Okay. Well, I want to bring up Ben, who's going to talk about an opportunity that he is going to announce to everybody.
I work for a nonprofit here on campus called VIA. We're an educational exchange organization, and in the spring, I wanted to solicit some help from people in the class or community members. We'll be bringing a group of students from universities in Japan here to Stanford to study social entrepreneurship. They'll be here for 2 weeks, and they'll be working on projects with three students from Stanford and Berkeley. Sorry, I can't see this too clearly, but we want them to learn about social innovation. We want them to design solutions to different problems in Japan, and then also implement those when they go to Japan. And we're giving them a few options for their projects during the 2 weeks. They can work with partners, or they can develop their own project. So it's kind of similar to what some of you are doing here in class. We have three partners, one that's around education issues, another focusing on environmental issues, and we also have a project working on disability and employment issues. But actually, this group will be working on some assistive technology issues as well. So we were wondering if any of you would be available or have time during your spring break. We're looking for some students who've been involved with the course or anyone in the community who's got experience with assistive technology or disability issues to kind of consult our teams prior to their presentations, which will be on March 29th here at Stanford. So it's really like a 1.5-day commitment. It'd be coming to their presentations, attending those on the morning of Thursday, March 29th. Also, between the 26th and the 28th, kind of meeting with them independently in their group. So if any of you have an interest or would like to know more about our program, I'll be here after class, and I can give you my card or also some more information.
Anybody have any questions right now for Ben? Okay. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thanks so much.
I want to go over midterm reports a little bit. Basically, there's a structure, a suggested structure, and this is in the on your handout that you got the first day, and it's also on the course website. So I'm not going to go over this a lot, but you know, there's lots of different categories, so it should be easy for you to just start building some text in there. And I think for the midterm report, it's a 5-page paper, which should be pretty easy to do considering you're going to have photographs and other things in there too. So this is pretty straightforward. This is the kind of format that you would see, that you would submit if you were doing a scientific paper, pretty much this format. So what you're doing now is exercise practice for a more scientific paper. The presentation grading is three basic factors: the quality of the presentation itself, the quality of the process that you employed, and any visualizations or prototypes that you have at this point. Those are all scored. And I'll be sending out an email which details this a little bit more. I just finished doing the evaluation forms, everybody will evaluate everybody else. So it's not just me evaluating you, it's everybody evaluating you. So that's what your audience is. And this includes community people and students. So you're all welcome to come, bring friends, ought to be good. Since we have 8 teams and 10 minutes per team, it's going to go over a little bit. So if you're going to be here, prepare to go over, or you can leave early. But I wanted to ask teams, if there's any team that needs to go at the beginning or at the end or in the middle, please let me know by email, and I'll adjust the schedule appropriately. So I've been getting updates from the team, so that's good. I want to continue to see those updates, so I know that you're actually working on something. Otherwise, I don't have any idea. So keep that coming on. I especially want to hear about your experiences in room 36, and also want to know about any problems you might have with people, with parts, with ordering, stuff like that. So you know where to find me. So earlier this week, Professor Nelson sent me a link that talked about this robotic walking stick. And it was such an interesting project that I thought I'd use it as the basis of a discussion today. So let me go through, you know, what it said. And this was actually from a patent. So Toyota and IIT have developed a robotic walking stick that offers users a way to right themselves when they begin to fall. So here's the person, and here's a stick, and there's a wheel on the back of it, and a hand grip. The device consists of a bidirectional chunky rubber wheel that is driven by motors at the foot of the stick that is packed with balance sensing accelerometers. So there's accelerometers in here, and this is a wheel that can rotate both ways. The hand grip has a force sensor with which the user controls the strength of the wheel's forward motion or backward motion. So as you grip harder on this, it will the wheel will go forward or reversed, and I think that depends on the orientation of the stick itself. So here's how it works. If the user starts to fall forwards, gripping the handle causes the wheel to slowly but strongly push back on the user's arm, hopefully righting them. Everybody got that? If they start falling backwards, the accelerometer sends the direction needed to push them back upright. So the questions I have for you is, you know, I want you to evaluate this design. You know, as engineers, you're going to have to do that. So this is a good example of that. So this is all that was in the article. There is a patent that is online as well that pretty much goes over the same stuff, but maybe somebody can comment on the design, if you think it's going to be useful, and who might benefit from this device, and maybe you can predict if it's going to be a commercial success. Cindy, do you have any thoughts?
I don't know. I just don't see how you can help someone to stand up, right? By just rotating this thing, because you can't do this force on their arm.
Why won't the force help them right themselves?
I just have a hard time visualizing it because I feel like it's not that stable.
Oh, so because the cane only has one point of contact here, you might not get the force transmitted up that. Elaine? It's probably a rubber material. Just like a regular wheel. Let's assume that it's a regular wheel. Small wheel, so maybe like 4 inches around.
So what's to keep it from going out?
Are you asking me, or?
It's theoretical. Anybody.
Well, it's supposed to push in the right direction so that it helps you.
It may be like a Dyson wheel. The Dyson vacuum cleaner that has the big wheel that's literally a ball.
Yeah. Well, I think this is, it says it's a wheel. It doesn't say
but
it's a ball.
If you go back one spot, it says it's multi-axis.
No, it says it's a multi-axis accelerometer, so that's a device that measures the orientation of the vertical portion of that cane. So it knows if it's tilted forward or backwards.
So it sounds like a lot of it is kind of based on similar technology that goes into like ABS brakes, that, you know, it's got all this feedback, and whether how useful it is really depends on how well it's engineered, you know,
okay.
For that.
Okay.
From this, we have no idea if it's total junk or really amazing.
Yeah, it's not clear at all if they've tested it with people.
Yeah.
There was no indication in this article that they did, and the patent wouldn't include that information either.
Right. And if it's really good, there's probably a lot of technology, and it's, you know, at least initially it would be pretty expensive. But, you know, if Japan, we're really interested in preventing older people from breaking hips, you know, they might fund actually people using something like this. You know, a lot of commercial success in this market is how it fits in with healthcare system.
Okay, thank you.
I definitely agree. I think whether or not people use it more than, because even if it's a great product, no one uses it at this point. So, I think because it's on a wheel, it would probably change the way someone who uses a cane looks at how they use
right.
a cane, because I'm guessing it has to like be in contact with the ground, maybe, so...
You well, you definitely have to be in contact
with the ground. So you would be rolling it instead of like actually moving it. So it changes the way you walk. And then
yeah, well, the fact that it's pictured in the back here means that, you know, I assume that you use it as a cane, that you would... You know, that it would move with you, not you're not rolling it in front of you or behind you. That was my assumption.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that's true or not, but that was my assumption.
I think in either case, it's still different from what we conceive of a cane is now.
Yeah.
So even if it's better, people can use it. And then I guess the price is important, but also whether or not Medicare health insurance is big.
Right. Bembe? So you bring up a good point. You know, you just don't fall forward or backward.
Right, exactly.
A lot of people fall straight down.
Right.
People fall to the left or right. So
it seems like this is pretty much dependent on one point of contact. And so if it'll apply a force in one direction, it'll help you up. And I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Elaine, thank you. Are you asking me again? I'm not the... we actually did have a project in here about 3 years ago that were there was two canes. We made a two-cane system. So, yeah, I'm done. A Segway, yeah.
Small Segway.
A one-wheel Segway.
Yes. And what's the terrain like? Where is he walking?
Well, it looks like it's walking on level ground here.
Flat only?
I don't know if it didn't say.
Stairs or gravel?
Right.
Does that
well, that's a good point. You know, how well will this work on stairs? What if you're walking upstairs and fall and start to fall over? Might not work, right? Yeah.
I'm thinking of it as a riderless Segway, and that makes me think of what's the mass down on the bottom of the flywheel required? Is it going to weigh more or less than the person?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. If you're carrying this around all the time and it has a motor and batteries in it and electronics, it might weigh a significant amount, and so that may be deterrent from using it as a cane. Nicole?
What happens when it's dying, you have to end it.
Well, well, hopefully you don't fall and it will still work as a cane. Yeah.
So there are a lot of, I mean, negative thoughts, but I thought if the wheel could just have enough torque to remain stationary, it could just act like a bar which you hold on.
Right.
When you're falling in. If you have a bar around you, I think, which is stationary, it can prevent you from falling in any direction, at least to a certain point. And
yeah, this isn't really a bar because it's not connected to the...
But the wheel might have enough torque, so it would basically be stationary in most of the cases and move in a direction so that, just to ensure that you, if you're falling in a particular direction, it pulls you in the other.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Let me ask you a question here. What's the path of the force? You know, it starts out on the ground and it goes up the cane. And there's a pivot point here, and then it has to go through the hand, the wrist, the elbow, the shoulder, and the center of gravity is maybe around here, right? So what happened? Oh, okay.
Well, we have very complicated kinematics.
Okay.
Multi-body kinematics in both the sensing and in the actuation.
Okay.
And so there are lots of variables you're not controlling.
Okay.
And so I would suspect the control algorithm would be pretty tough to produce.
Okay. Anybody else have thoughts on the kinematics?
It seems like it requires a lot of upper body strength. I mean, so if the fork, I mean, if you're relying on the combination of the cane and actually steadying you.
Okay. Let me give you a situation. Imagine that you're using a cane and your elbow is flexed. What happens there when it's producing a force? Where's that force going? It's going to go in my mind, it's going to flex your arm more, right? So the force isn't going to be transmitted, you know, to your center of gravity. Okay. Well, here it's behind you, so I would imagine that it's functioning as a standard cane. Now, why would it be behind you if you're rolling it? Why would they have a picture of it behind you if you're rolling it in front of you?
Because to avoid the constant pounding from the shoulder up and down, I actually modify a cane.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I just bought one of those basic umbrella shapes handles.
Right. Okay. Okay. Okay.
So I push, I'll roll along, and when I need upright, I've got the tip. But the whole idea was to have that spring to take the pressure off.
Okay.
So I thought, why not roll along when you can, as opposed to up and down motion?
Well, if you're rolling it, then it may not, if it's just rolling along, it's not providing any balance.
Well, I guess it depends on
right.
How much is going.
Right. Okay. That's fair. But let's think about what happens when you fall. This device requires that you have your hand on this grip here and control the force on the grip in order to make the thing operate. Now, when you fall, imagine, let's think about the last time you fell that you had maybe a bag of groceries or something with you. Do you think that a person is going to have the control of their hands and are going to be able to operate this as they're falling and it's in the right position? Fernanda?
Interesting that this device is coming from behind, back here, which is, I can understand the posture, that now your hips are forward and your shoulders are back. But more than likely, in my experience, as some of my peers experience, when we fall forward.
Okay.
We fall forward or we cave underneath ourselves.
Right.
And our recovery time on that, depending also on the body's reaction, for the most part, it stiffens up.
But do you think you're going to have the awareness to operate this device as you're falling? And it's going to be in the right position to provide force that you need to stop falling?
If that's the case, it's not going to happen from back here. If that's the case, I want to see it. Because right. My only contact of my falling is my
Right.
I want to know where I'm going. Yeah.
Right.
And if it's behind me, I don't have anything back there to secure me that I'm going to just kind of fall and sit on my butt. If anything, the first thing that's going to react is I'm going to contract it. Everything is going to pull in this way, so the crutches is going to go with me.
Right. And what happens if you fell on this device?
What happens on this? Hopefully, I'm very well covered because otherwise I'll be cut out.
Right. Okay. Okay, so my assessment is that this thing is not going to work at all. It's just fanciful, and they just got a patent on it. And at the first microsecond you think about it, you know, it's a good idea. But as you put any other thought into it, it just doesn't make any sense at all. That's my evaluation of it. Last thing.
I'd like to suggest that the reason it's shown behind is to simplify the life of the illustrator.
Right. Well, they say that it will work if you're falling forwards or falling backwards, and so this is the falling backwards scenario. And so I think that you're supposed to walk with it as if it were a cane rather than roll it. Right. Yep.
I think I don't want to use this.
Okay.
Put me out because my shoulder is strong.
Okay.
Not just one, but maybe two.
No, just carrying this device along, anything that weighs more than a normal cane, it's going to be heavy. And if you're carrying this all day, that's going to be a real problem. Well, thanks so much for your evaluation. I hope I got you thinking about these things and to be critical about some of these things that you see. Not everything that is on the market or is patented is necessarily a good device and something that will work. But I would think that if they just had thought of this as an idea and did a patent on it. But I'll let you know if I see anything more about it. Okay. So next Tuesday, Nancy Frischberg will be here, and she's going to be talking about what's up with the telephone, and she's going to address users that are deaf. So we're actually going to have a sign language interpreter here, and Nancy is very well known as, she actually wrote a book on sign language interpreting. And I look back, and we gave a talk together at SRI in February of, wow, it's almost exactly 7 years ago we gave a talk together. So that's going to be interesting. But today we're going to have Anushka Perkins here by Skype. She's going to be talking about designing inclusive user interfaces, and she's from Microsoft. And we'll take a few moments to get connected via Skype. In the meantime, please sign the sheet if you have it, and take another cookie, and cross your fingers to see if this will work. The audio will be recorded, and the slides will be up there, and there's a video that she has that is up there, but so you're not going to see the. I can't record the video,
right.
But the rest of the stuff you can do, and if you go through that and write your one to two-page summary and send it to me, I'll count you as an attending.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank
a lot. Okay. What am I doing?
Is there a way to dim more of the overhead lights to make this brighter, relatively brighter?
I can turn off more lights. I turned off half of them. It's going to be really dark otherwise. I'll do that. How's that?
Hey, Anushka, it's Dave. I'm ready to call you. Okay, let's give it a shot. It says connecting, which is a good sign. I did. It said call failed. So let me call again. Why don't you try calling? Oh, there it is. I got you. Answer. Okay. Start my video. Full screen video. There you are. Oh my God. Hold on. Okay, let's get the volume adjusted. Can you hear me? Okay. Yes, I can. I want to make sure that the studio audience hears me as well.
Okay.
I think we're good.
Okay, great. Hello?
Okay. Let me,
all right.
Let me introduce you. Anushka Perkins has worked for accessibility for Microsoft for 11 years, from speccing and designing features to product planning to envisioning future interactions. She has extensive experience in research and design for Windows accessibility features, deep knowledge of accessibility, user needs, and accessibility control panel, and expertise in accessible technology. She drove the redesign of the accessibility control panel in the Windows operating system. On the basis of market data, she defined changes in the end user presentation of the Windows accessibility features and created prototypes to illustrate the new design. She's a former Microsoft representative to the W3C Web Accessibility Initiatives Working Group that defines how to design accessible web content. She was on the advisory board for the National Center for Technology Innovation, and she is a renowned industry resource for insights into accessibility and usability. So let's give her a big hand from Stanford. And in case your mouth gets dry, I brought some water for you.
Okay.
Okay, you're on.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you, everybody, for joining me via Skype. This is kind of fun for me. I've never done a Skype presentation, so we'll see how this goes. And what I plan to do is to talk for about 30 minutes and then open it up for questions at the end. And so let's get started, and I'm going to switch over to my computer here. Let's see. Okay. Okay. So what I wanted to do was sort of start with the broad perspective of, you know, what's Microsoft's kind of perspective on accessibility and why do we care about accessibility? And we have our vision, you know, the overall vision to enable people to reach their full potential. That's the overall Microsoft vision. And that's, you know, dovetails really nicely with accessibility, that we want to enable people of all abilities to realize their full potential. And Microsoft creates technology that is accessible to people around the world of all ages and abilities. And to support this mission, I'm part of a central group at Microsoft. We sit in the Trustworthy Computing Organization, and Trustworthy Computing is comprised of online safety, privacy, security, and accessibility. So it's part of our initiatives to create an experience that people can rely on and have confidence in. And so we're a central organization, and we help product groups around the country, around the company, like Windows and Office and Kinect, all of the product groups, to understand what they need to do for accessibility, why it's important, and understand the design process. And for today, what I wanted to cover was to convey, you know, what our goals are and vision for accessible technology, how we go about understanding what our customer needs are, how we approach inclusive design. A lot of what we focus on is really driving for innovative solutions, and I hope to show you a couple of examples that you would inspire you and see kind of what we are hoping can come together to be innovative in the space. And then resources that we have up on the web, especially ones that are available for college students. So, you know, as we know, technology is everywhere. It's around the world. It's growing and growing. It's becoming more what, you know, the term natural user experiences, which really means it's multimodal. You can use speech input, touch. You can carry it with you. It's supposed to be able to respond more to who we are naturally, right? And that comes with limitations too, and whether those are environmental limitations because we're in a loud environment, or if it's situational, like maybe I'm carrying a bag of groceries with me and I don't have full use of both of my hands, you know, I still want to be able to use technology. And so this is something that's been important for us for accessibility. You know, I've been on this team for about 11 years now, and this idea of multimodal and seamless experiences has been what, you know, we see as needed, right? When you have different assistive technologies that are working along with your desktop computer in the, you know, traditional sense, we need all those things to work really nicely together. And now I think we're really at this converging point where the mainstream user and the accessibility user have a lot of similar desires. So that's one angle that we're looking at this at. This is kind of another angle, you know, that this was more, you know, what is the accessibility market in the U.S.? And how do you help start breaking out this problem into, or this problem space into, how many people would use or benefit from using accessible technology? And this data is from a study that we did with Forrester Research back in 2003. So it is a bit dated, but the numbers are only growing, right? Because we're only, the aging population around the world has an impact here. And this was really surprising when we released this data, to find that 57% of computer users are likely or very likely to benefit from accessibility needs. And that was ages 18 to 64. And kind of why we use this likely or very likely, it's because either you are in a situation where you absolutely need it, like you need your screen reader to use technology, or you need an alternative input device. Or it could be that you sometimes like to use high contrast, or so there's that whole range, that spectrum that we talk about. And so that's why this wording, it's a little bit cumbersome, but that's to get at this whole range. And then when you look at vision impairments and dexterity, those were the two highest categories of disabilities that we found. 1 in 4 for both visual and having pain in their wrist or hands. And then 1 in 5 has a hearing difficulty. And part of our methodology that we used was to not just look at how you use how you define, like, do you self-identify with having a disability, but also how are you impacted in everyday tasks? So we ask questions like, do you ever have problems holding up a pen or a pencil? Do you ever have a problem hearing somebody in conversation? So by looking at the everyday tasks, we kind of opened up the net and found people that maybe they wouldn't say that they had a vision impairment or something, but they did identify with having one of these, being in one of these categories based on their tasks. And, you know, just one anecdote that I've run usability studies for Windows and accessibility, and I remember doing a study with somebody who he wore a hearing aid, and during the course of the study, he said, well, I don't have a hearing problem, but my wife makes me wear this. Or another man, this was, you know, really touching. This other man said he had Parkinson's, and when one of the questions, you know, we have in Windows in the ease of access control panel asks you about your daily task, and one is like about memory. Do you ever have problems remembering things? And he answered no during the usability study, that his memory was fine. And then at the end of the study, I asked him about his thoughts about the study and those questions. And he said, well, I guess now that I think about it, I do sometimes have problems remembering where my keys are, or I have been having more problems with my memory. And so it just shows, you know, the complexity and kind of delicateness and nuances that go into building accessible technology, because people are coming at it with so many different perspectives. And so when we look at, you know, that's the market, kind of that target opportunity, the available opportunity there. But really we see so much overlap in kind of like what I was saying with the aging demographic, people who are illiterate and would rather have more visual, if visual icons were in place too, that would help them. Quality assurance testing for them to do automated testing is another use of the accessibility APIs, and I can go into that more if there's interest there. But we're looking for places where the accessibility and the mainstream customer really overlap, and there's combined needs, and that's where we see really the sweet spot to be. And so with that approach, kind of one of the examples is like, you know, where's Waldo in here? And we all wish sometimes we had a magnifier available, or we had a text engine here helping us find where Waldo is. It's all just depends on the task at hand and our situation that we're and we actually use this graphic when we first rolled out the new magnifier in Microsoft Windows to then turn on full screen magnification, and you could zoom in. And I bet people are wondering really where Waldo is. I see David really looking closely here at the screen. So that's a little teaser for you. Since you held that water bottle up in front of me, then this is my payback to you. Where's Waldo? Okay. So knowing that that's kind of our goal, that we have products that are usable by everybody, you know, it's still a process, and the end goal of what does that actually look like, you know, it's not evident. There's not just one answer out there. If we look at the problem of designing a wheeled vehicle to help somebody get around, well, it depends. You know, as the graphics here show, you know, I have, 9 different pictures of a tricycle. There could be a automated wheelchair. There could be an extreme athlete in a really high-speed, high-efficient wheelchair. There's a futuristic one in the bottom that looks kind of like this upright bubble. And so this is kind of our goal with our approach, too, that we really understand what is the user doing, what are their capabilities, what's their environment like? Are they in a home? Are they outside? Or are they on the move? And then designing an optimal solution for that. And this graph shows how we look, kind of some of the categories that we talk about, from traditional disabilities, then temporary conditions, and customer preference. So like one example here, if you look along the spectrum of like hearing, you know, traditionally we would talk about deafness and hard of hearing. And then the temporary condition is that you could be in a loud environment, like you could be on the factory floor and there's all the machinery going on and it's buzzing and it's loud. And so it's difficult to hear your phone or watch a video on your screen. Or you're at the gym and so they don't turn on the TV, so captionings are up on the TV at the gym. Or your customer preference. You could just really prefer, especially if you're watching a learning video, that you're getting that visual input and you're also seeing the text underneath. Maybe that's the style that works best for you. So these next couple of slides just talk about our process and some of the techniques and methods that we use to aid our engineers. You know, and personas is a big one for developing software and hardware as well. And so this shows some examples. We have some of these defined up on our marketing site, and I have a link later on. And it's just gives the example of when we can look at things by which impairment are they most impacted by, like say it's dyslexia. And then this description of we could say she's a student, a future fashion designer, and she uses learning software to help with her dyslexia. And what are some solutions that have there? Well, so we've named her Vanessa. She uses a computer equipped with learning software, such as a talking dictionary, phonetic spell check, and word prediction. And you know, this is a great tool for the product groups when they can target their personas. Like, this is really a mainstream tool that we use to use personas. And so for us to have defined ones that deal with accessibility issues is really helpful just for the product team to understand this. And we've done things like, maybe we'll take the personas that the product team has created. Maybe they have already a Vanessa who is a student, and it's some learning software, a website that's being rolled out. And then we'll talk about, well, what if Vanessa has dyslexia? Then what does that do to your functional design of your product? And how can we really highlight like spell check that's in there, or text to speech that's in there? So, you know, it just helps tell the story. And have a consistent story of how that product is supporting various people. I love this. I took this from the newspaper, this picture, and it shows that the some automobile engineers at Nissan, they were donning suits to help them immerse themselves in what is it like to be an older person. And so they have cataract goggles to impair their vision and a neck restraint. They're limiting their joints and their flexibility in their arms and their legs, wearing gloves to reduce finger dexterity. So I just thought this was a great – I mean, I can't imagine if they go in there and then try to use their prototype car is what that is like. And this is sort of the – one of the goals that I have for software is how do we put on the neck restraint and the goggles and everything for us to really understand what it's like, to try to understand and design for people. And this kind of immersive – way, because one of the challenges, you know, working at a large company like Microsoft is there's like, you know, 60,000 employees, and we're a small team, right? But yet we want all the engineers and designers to be able to either by talking to customers or using tools that can help simulate what color blindness looks like, for example, on your screen, that just helps them, right, to understand the users. And so then we have some things here that we've, this is from a slide that we passed out or have done at presentations internally and at World Usability Day, just to get their minds thinking of, like, how would you use your feature without a mouse? What if you couldn't see, how would you use that? What if you're looking at your just a small portion of your screen because it's been blown up by the magnifier? Okay, and so here's an example of kind of taking those principles and that approach and thinking about what would an fully accessible media player look like. This was done by our team as a prototype. And so this, what this shows is in Silverlight, that's just the technology that we use to build this. It's a web technology, that there's a video here in the middle, and it's these ads that we used to have on the air a lot about, I'm a PC. And so this is that screenshot of Bill Gates saying, I'm a PC, and I wear glasses. And so along the bottom, you'll see there's the caption for what he's saying. Along the top is the audio description that would be read and also text. So the audio description is Bill Gates holds groceries in a parking lot. An email address, bill@windows.com, is overlaid. And then in the corner here, the bottom right, we have the sign language translator. And so she's signing along with what he is saying. And I think here, yeah, so this just points out where these elements are on the screen. And we also have a full text transcript along the left side. And then, of course, we did the work, you know, to make sure the controls are programmatically accessible for screen reader and high contrast works and everything. So sometimes it just takes kind of doing a prototype like this for people to go, aha, okay, I get it now. And yeah, it's possible with technologies that exist today. It's often not a technology. Well, there's technology problems that need to be solved, but sometimes it's just putting the pieces together in a usable way. That's the issue. Okay. Here's a kind of another example of a prototyping research project we did, and this is with Mary Morrison, Microsoft Research, and Sean Kane. He was a PhD student at University of Washington, and now he is a professor. And we were looking at the Surface desktop touch screen. You know, it's a large screen that's basically like a coffee table. And so it's a horizontal screen, and, you know, it's not accessible to people who are blind. So we added the voice, text-to-speech voice to talk, and then we also looked at other ways to interact with the graphics. So here is just a picture of a world map with different cities that are highlighted, like Cape Town and Rio and Sydney, and one of the techniques we were trying is, what if you had a little mini version of just the hot spots of the cities in the corner? And so somebody, because it's the Surface is meant to be very interactive, that there's two or more people sitting there and you're sitting on opposite sides of the table. So we thought, well, you might want to have your own little space that you can explore, and you could be listening to your text-to-speech and hearing the location and getting yourself oriented right before you like engage in the larger space. So this was just one of the ideas that we tried, but is an example of some explorations that we're doing to improve touch access. And then I wanted to mention, you know, out in the market, we have Kinect, which works on the Xbox gaming console, and we just released a SDK, the software development kit for Windows, so you can build solutions using the Kinect on your Windows PCs. And what the Kinect camera does, it's a motion sensing camera that sits on top of your monitor, much like a webcam would, but it can detect your skeleton. So if you can see here in the default mode where there's the green skeleton, it's just the outline of the person that is showing, you know, we are tracking where their arms are, where their head is, and where their legs are. And now with this new release, we introduced this near mode, which you can be closer to the camera and there's more fidelity where you can pick up like finger positions there. and it does facial recognition. I mean, it's pretty. I saw the demo of this, and it can detect extreme kind of emotions. Like it can tell if you're really happy or if it can tell if you're frowning, you know. And of course, as the technology gets better, we'll be able to tell more discrete kind of emotions. So it's you know, it's a first step. It's also doing voice recognition. So even when you're sitting on your couch in your living room, you know, and you have your Xbox game set up, you can give voice commands into the game console. So this has really kind of taken off, you know, with rehab specialists using this, hospitals, using this because, you know, you don't have to touch the devices. So it can be used maybe if you're prepped for surgery and you're the doctor, but you want to review some of your procedures or the x-rays with motion sensing, you can control, like what you're looking at, but not have to touch anything. So that's just one example where it's really gone away from the gaming experience, but into these really interesting and very relevant for healthcare and accessibility. I also wanted to mention, you know, the Imagine Cup, which is where students around the world can participate in competitions. And, you know, their theme is to imagine a world where technology helps solve the toughest problems facing us today. And it's all aligned around the UN Millennium Goals, which include things like achieve universal primary education, improve maternal health, ensure environmental sustainability, et cetera. And this has been a really great showcase for accessibility. Even I started an accessibility competition within the Imagine Cup a few years ago. But even before I did that, students were creating projects related to accessibility. And then I did a few years where I had accessibility competitions, and then I stopped this year, but it's kept going. And it's always just so motivating to see the great projects that are coming out of the Imagine Cup. And this year, actually, they gave some grants. They started a new program where they give business grants to a few of the – like I think there's four projects that get business grants because they're based on, like, the viability of a business idea and – the promise that's there to turn this into a business. And all of them were related to either healthcare and accessibility, which is really amazing. Here's some of the categories of competitions, like software design, game design, using Windows Phone, et cetera. And a few years ago in 2009, I wanted to share this with you after hearing from David some of the projects that this class is working on, is that there was a project from a team in Mexico, and what they did was they wanted to help kids who are going through rehab and learning how to use a wheelchair, but if it was, like, it just became tedious or difficult, you know, and they wanted to make it fun and motivating. So what they did was hooked up. You would sit in the wheelchair, and it wasn't moving. It was on a platform, so you wouldn't actually move, but you could move the wheels. And then they had microcontrollers set up that would interpret, you know, whether you're moving forward or back and which wheel was moving. And then that would convert that into Xbox control, whether you're moving right or left or forward or back. And they made an Xbox game that was kind of moving through space, and you would – fly to your planet, and then you could, you know, they constructed a whole game around you moving that way. So that was one of our top winners that year. I also wanted to mention, you know, the world of autism, and this is one example where we funded, Microsoft External Research funded a project to put PECS, the PECS picture exchange communication system, on a mobile device and use that for mobile communications. You know, and I just think there's so much promise with, like with Kinect and the facial recognition and motion sensing, and to really do great things in this area. There's an autism center here in the Redmond area called Lakeside. And they are using Kinects in their therapy for kids with autism. And they're I went and saw their center, and they have like a room set up where the Kinect is there, and they're just playing the games off the shelf. Some of them are like obstacle courses, or maybe you're playing with an animal. And they said, like, with one child, they were working on having him respond and show feedback and communication with his therapist. So, like, if he made reached an achievement in a game, they wanted to see a high five from the kid. You know, and this was something they'd said they would usually have to break down, do it over a long period of time. And with the Kinect, it just happened so quickly that he was so excited with the game, and he, you know, made it through some part of the obstacle course and did the high five with the therapist. And so just things like that where we can combine, you know, the natural motivations that people have with what the technology can do. I just really excited to see what continues to come out of that area. So kind of in summary, we really look at this inclusive innovation idea where we look at usability, accessibility together, and really try to get as deep an understanding of our customers and what they're doing to meet their needs. You know, we have efforts where we are looking at not just what tools are developers using, what testing tools are there, but also what programs can be put into place to educate people about building accessible products. And then we're looking at different forms of media, that it's documents, it's audio, it's video. It's kind of the full scope of what we do that needs to be accessible. And then I have a lot of resources, and I'll send this to David so he can post it later. There is, for university students, free development software that includes Visual Studio and Expression Blend. It's called dreamspark.com is where you can go to download that. Then I have some resources and links here about research, too, that about conducting research and et cetera. So I guess I'd like to open it up to questions and see what people are interested in. I can definitely dive into more areas.
Let's see if I can plug in my wireless mic to the microphone input on the PC. And then... Okay, Nicole, you had a question? No, please, just talk.
Do you have anything to say in regards to accessibility with Office 2007 and 2010 and Windows 7?
Did you hear that?
Yeah, do I have anything to say about Office 2010 and Windows 7? And I want to say hi, Nicole, because I believe I met you and Mary, and you came and talked to Microsoft Research, I think in the summertime. So, well, I guess, did you have a more specific question? Because what we do, you know, I know that we have assistive technology that works with both of those. Can you hear me okay? Dave, can you hear you? Okay. Yeah, so we have, you know, our built-in assistive technology and a lot of third-party, like, screen readers that work with Windows 7 and Office 2010. I know that there are some gaps there, and depending on which product. You know, we go for a consistency of accessibility across the products, but I know that there are issues, and they have a very active accessibility team working on the next version of Office. So I was curious if you had any specific questions about that. Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, you know, it's one of those, you know, those are such big products that it's a very, you know, it's one of our main areas of focus of working with both of those products for accessibility, and we continue to do so for their next versions. So.
I have a question. I just wondered about how pervasive the accessibility paradigm is within Microsoft. Is it just within your group, or have you made inroads into other groups and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is one of our charters, is to get people that work in each product group to own accessibility. So we'll have like somebody who works on, like say it's one of the MSN websites, that they own the accessibility of that product. And then we have like we call them accessibility champs, and then we have a network of them that work together to share ideas. And also I work a lot with the UX community, the user experience community, so that's researchers and designers, and talking with them about what their goals are with the product and giving my perspective and coming together with some common goals. So it's definitely it's an ongoing dialogue and conversation. But like I said at the beginning, with the natural UI, there's a lot more fruitful conversations happening now. Right, yeah, that's a great point. We do have people with disabilities working at Microsoft, and there are different organizations that are set up where there's communities of people with similar disabilities that talk a lot about, you know, how things are going and issues that they're facing, and we do. And so they are, you know, if part of their role is to work on their product and accessibility, then they are involved that way. But many of them are working on just regular mainstream features within the product, whether that's gaming or Office. You know, I know people all in various different parts of the, working on different products. And so what happens though is that a lot of times someone designing a new feature will want feedback from, like say it's from people with color blindness. And so we'll reach out to these internal aliases and ask them for feedback. And so we're involved, they are involved that way, kind of as a representative group of power users and expert computer users who can give us early feedback on products. But then we really try to go out and do research with people in the community, like the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind or other organizations, to get user feedback. So there's different layers, yeah, of how people are involved. But I definitely think we benefit so much when they're part of the design team. And there, we have like a kind of a board of on accessibility of, I talked about the champs, but we have kind of really engaged people, and we often review things like personas and guidelines and things that we have with that expert group of users. Okay, thank you.
Anybody else?
Thank you.
the structure of the Imagine Cup, which is a the competition run by Microsoft. And so every entry, every student project has to say what Millennium goal that they are investigating and providing a solution for. So if it's like primary education that's available to everybody is one of the UN Millennium goals. And then one of the projects could be about, well, there was one last year about using a Windows tablet for someone with autism to communicate and using text-to-speech within the Windows and helping her communicate with her family and her teacher, and that was kind of structured underneath that goal of primary education. Does that make sense? Is that okay, thanks. Yeah, that's true that it's getting more, you know, there's such rich visuals being shared. And right now what the screen readers convey, it's called alternative text. So it's just a string that goes along with that image. But, you know, it's kind of static because you assign one alternative text. Like maybe you have a picture of like a mountain scene. Right, and we struggle with this. How do you describe that to the person adequately? That what is it that you convey? Do you say this is, you know, Mount Rainier? Do you say a snowy day on Mount Rainier? Do you say a wonderful, glorious Mount Rainier day that makes you want to leave your work and go out into the mountains? So that's kind of one of our challenges with that, is that it's and a lot of our writers who write UI text or help documentation, they're the ones in the product that write what that description is. But I think there's kind of room, you know, there's room there for what, like a study. I think it'd be really interesting to, what would you say if you're really sitting down with somebody who couldn't see it and you were describing it to them? What would you say? Or if you're in a different learning environment and it was a kid, and you're in a geography lesson, that could be very different than if you're doing a Bing search or Google search and you're looking for pictures of mountains. You would describe them differently.
I actually think Stanford has a description facility here, and I'll look them up.
Okay. Thank you. That's a great point. And what there's two things. One is that we need to put accessibility into our products at the earliest stages, at the lowest levels. So if there's a new type of technology that's coming out, like Silverlight was a new technology a few years ago, with the way that developers made a Silverlight app, they used different kinds of controls. It wasn't like Windows controls. dialogue, and they're picking, okay, I want buttons, and I want checkboxes, and I need text. Those are the common controls that they're using. And within that is baked in accessibility, like programmatic access to assistive technology devices. So that it's the developers of that, those common controls have to really understand how that has to work. It's not every single developer in the world has to build it in those hooks. Another thing is that, like you mentioned, security, and some of the, we have a vendor program where we work with assistive technology vendors, and we understand, you know, some of the ways that they're getting information to convey then to the screen reader users or other types of assistive technology. And so what we, I think so that we can innovate, we need to use all the standard programmatic interfaces that are in place. So this is getting kind of technical, but you asked the question, and so I think you want this level of answer that we because the security mechanisms, they will work with the approved, like, APIs, basically the programming communication and protocol that's in place. If programs are starting to go around those, which they had to do in the past because the APIs didn't provide what they needed, but now we're moving where everything is provided by these APIs, and so there's no need to go around and do all this other hooking that got in the way of security. Because the problem was that a computer program that's running didn't know if, what is it that's trying to find out what my text is or insert text into my program? Is that a valid program? Is that a virus? What is that? And so if they're using the APIs, we know they're kind of registered and they're kind of approved and they have to go through some security levels. So I think it's like engineering things in the right way is what's going to help us stay with the pace of innovation and really good communication between companies like us and the assistive technology vendors is also key.
Thank you. I just want to say it's after 5:30, so anybody who has to leave is welcome to do so quietly. But I think there's some more questions, so anybody who wants to come back is welcome to. So let's maybe wait a minute and then continue. Do you have a question?
Yeah. So one of the things you talked about right in the beginning, and that, you know, I see a lot of, is we have this aging population, and everyone talks about, oh, they're going to want to use software, you know, to give them abilities. But in reality, they usually don't. They don't want to admit that they can't do this or they can't. And so, you know, there's some products like where it's actually part of the obvious user preference, those kinds of things. And so, you know, do you guys have the opportunity to work with, you know, your employees that are, you know, 45 and older who, you know, they have some of these issues, or they're starting to, and is that an entirely different kind of effort? And how does it fit in with, you know,
Yeah, I think that it's a tricky area because there is some overlap in, like, vision. Like, we know that your vision changes as you get older, and your dexterity and cognition. So there is some direct overlap with accessibility. But then there's also some other issues that are happening at the same time, maybe changes in your work situation or your lifestyle or your healthcare needs. So it's not that all of their, we can only understand it by looking at their accessibility issues. It's more like a lifestyle change in the full picture. And so there isn't like a separate initiative at Microsoft that has to do with aging. It is part of what we do. There's somebody on our marketing team, Gary Moulton, who has been in the field a long time, and he spearheads some projects around marketing, and we've done some outreach to like a senior center where we set them up. Actually, Ellen Campbell on our marketing team did this project where they set up people in their rooms, like because it was a living facility. In their rooms, they had made sure they had the computers working and any assistive technology they needed and webcams, and then in the central areas of the facility, they also set up webcams where they would show what was happening in the central area. So even if somebody couldn't leave their room, they could still watch like the dance class that was going on or the art class that was going on in some area. They also made sure that they were able to have webcam communications with their family members. So it was sort of more like a case study of what does a connected facility, a living facility, look like, and what are the benefits to people because of that. And we just got such great testimonials from people about them feeling so much more connected to their community and their family, and it enriched their daily life and their well-being. So that's sort of, you know, I think some of it is getting technology to people. And maybe, like you said, they might not use what's there, but if it's just kind of built in, like, okay, here's how you increase your font, then that, and they need that, then they'll do it. But we have to make it really simple and easy to use. It can't be buried like 10 layers inside of a menu on how to do some of these basic things that are needed.
Okay. One more question.
Okay. Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not a specific research team that is looking at that specific angle that I know of, but there are people that are working on the facial recognition and looking at various scenarios of where that is really needed. And I can put you in touch with some people in that area and on that team to find out more about how the facial recognition, what can it track today, what you might be interested in doing, and we can talk about that. Definitely. I'd love to hear more about what you're exploring there. Okay, yes. Okay. do have those challenges, and you know, I'm sure you know too, working at Adobe, that it's the feature set that you're pushed in against. It's the scope of the business goals, the timeline that they're under, the resources that they have available. And so we try to, you know, support the accessibility requirements as much as we can with clear scenarios and user requirements, and getting everybody on the same page as early as possible. You know, and I wish every time it was successful, and I don't have like the answer for why. You know, sometimes it does work and sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it feels like it's the right having the right mix and generating that right mix and a lot of communication so that they really understand the impact. I think
you're right about the point of the process, and the other thing is getting involved very early in the process. Like you said, with Silverlight, was it? Getting involved very early in the design process before things get past and functional.
Yeah, and it's we try to become more of a fundamental. So, you know, just like security and online safety, and having that same urgency and criticalness as those other fundamentals, and also that if you want to build things to standards and be standards compliant, accessibility is part of being standards compliant. So, we kind of have these different justifications for accessibility.
So how much interaction do you have with the new phone group?
We do have interaction with them, and there's definitely a lot of dialogue going on with the phone team. And I think I know what you'll ask, but I don't know if you'll ask it.
No, I won't.
Okay, well, we can always follow up offline if you want to know, but it is challenging, you know, and it's sometimes it's, like you said, it's that pace of innovation and trying to meet the market demands. But our job and our mission is to make sure accessibility is right up there as a top priority.
Good luck.
Thank you. I'll need it.